Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We want to start the program today with a newsmaker interview with U.S. Senator Tim Scott. This year marks the 50th anniversary of President Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty. So throughout 2014, we've been talking about what poverty looks like in America now. And we've also been talking about what kinds of solutions are being talked about now. Many advocates say that a part of the problem is that few political leaders even talk about poverty anymore. And our next guest is one of the exceptions. Senator Scott, Republican from South Carolina, has been talking about poverty and how to address it from a conservative point of view since he was first elected to serve in the House in 2010. Considered a Tea Party favorite, he was appointed to fill the seat vacated by Senator Jim DeMint last year. And when he was, he became the first black senator to represent the South since the late 1800s. Senator Scott is up for election in his own right this year. He's been going about the job a bit differently than others, though. In addition to meeting with editorial boards and groups of supporters, he's also volunteered sans entourage at a Goodwill store. He's also had stints sweeping floors, bagging groceries, and waiting tables to better understand the issues of the working poor. And we reached him at his office on Capitol Hill. Senator Scott, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle. It's good to be on the show with you.
So let me start with asking you the premise of the point that I made in my introduction, which is a lot of people say that poverty is kind of off the radar with your colleagues from both sides of the aisle. Do you think that that's true?
Well, there's certainly an opportunity for us to move the entire country forward with no exceptions as it relates to economic issues, and it's important for us to focus on that.
But are you? Are you focusing on that?
We all need to focus on it more. There's no doubt about that. I think my office is doing so because my personal life's journey has started in poverty and led to opportunity, and I want to make sure that others who find themselves perhaps in the quagmire pit of poverty find a way out as well.
I was going to ask you about that. I mean, what calls you to this particular work? I mean, a lot of people have noted that you are, don't take offense at this, you're kind of following the Hillary Clinton rule, which is trying to be in your first term in the Senate a workhorse and not a show horse. You are, by dint of a lot of factors, already a national figure, but you have chosen very carefully what to be heard on in a national context, and you've clearly chosen this, and I wanted to ask why.
I think it's really it's one of the fastest and best ways for me to honor my mom's sacrifice and her struggle that has produced really two pretty successful guys, myself being the least of the two of us. My brother, being a command sergeant major in the United States Army, has risen to that rank because he had instilled in him work ethic, integrity, character, and a love and passion for people, and that led him into the military when he could no longer afford college. And for me, I think it's the same story. We found ourselves, when my parents were divorced, living with my grandparents in a two-bedroom house, which means that me, my brother, and my mother had to share one room. And ultimately, I think so often what shapes your worldview is what happens when you're young. And so for me, the challenge and the devastation of growing up without means and or resources shaped my worldview very clearly. And then I met a mentor who was a business owner who taught me that you could think, i.e. go through education to find a route out of poverty and not simply athletics or entertainment. And so I think I've just dedicated my life, according to my desires for the last 30 years, to positively impacting the lives of a billion people with a message of hope and opportunity. Hope has more to do with my faith, and opportunity has a lot to do with my financial literacy or financial independence, which, of course, leads into the opportunity agenda.
One recent step that you've taken, and if you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Republican Senator Tim Scott, Republican of South Carolina. We are talking about his conservative views on how to address poverty. This is part of our year-long series on poverty in America now, commemorating the 50th anniversary of LBJ's war on poverty. You teamed up with Senator Cory Booker, Democrat of New Jersey, to advance an idea for apprenticeship programs that would encourage people to, or give people sort of opportunities to work and to retrain and to refresh their skills. What's different about this idea than some of the things that are already out there?
Well, this is the old concept of earn while you learn. So here's an opportunity that I give credit to Cory for finding a great South Carolina idea that works, and then calling off on this South Carolina senator to join him. And the LEAP Act, of course, gives people a chance to experience work, i.e., and make a living, and at the same time become better trained and better equipped to make a bigger difference in the workforce. And so what the LEAP Act does is it provides a tax credit for employers for hiring people who we would consider the most vulnerable economically. And if you're younger, 25 and under, you get a larger tax credit for than hiring someone who's over 25.
What, can I ask you about people who say, look, I credit you on this whole question of investment in the future. Education is important to that and critical to that. But I need help now. I mean, there are people who need help now.
Yes.
The Democrats have been very critical of Republicans for trying to curtail, for example, the food stamp program and other sort of social supports that offer help to people right now. What do you say to that?
I think the criticism is not fair whatsoever. Here's the fact. The programs that help those who are dependent have gone up since 2008, 2010 by a high percentage. So the question really isn't cutting the baseline of those programs. It's finding an alternative where those programs will not be needed by the people who are currently benefiting from those programs. So I think how we frame the argument is how we create lather for constituencies. I don't want to.
Okay, but I understand. Forgive me, Senator, for interrupting. But what's the relevance of that to somebody who says, I don't care about all that? If there's growth in the numbers, it's because more people need the help.
Well,
so why aren't those two separate issues?
Michelle, it's a really simple answer, honestly. The answer is this, that if there are growth in the people who need the benefits, we ought to look at the underlying causes of the growth. If you are spending no time at all addressing that which creates the need, perhaps you'll never find the path to eliminating the need. And that's the real challenge. We have a bunch of folks in Congress focused on the need for tomorrow. The question is, when you look at the communities that are most vulnerable, how many people are focusing on their needs of the future? I would say not enough.
Can I ask you, I just spoke with your colleague in the South Carolina delegation, Congressman James Clyburn, earlier this week because he has penned a new memoir.
Yes,
he talks about his view that race still matters, that race is still a very critical part of the thinking of too many Americans in a way that works to the detriment of too many people of color, particularly African Americans. In his parlance, the people who look like me. And I'd like to ask you if you feel that that's true. You feel that race still plays a very big role in the consciousness of too many Americans. And what role does it play in your life?
Well, there's no doubt that we in America have evolved significantly and substantially over the last 50 years. So as to say that race is a smaller part of our construct than it's been in perhaps in the history of the country, certainly in my lifetime. I will tell you that there is an interesting delineation that I saw on stage when I did my Black Senators event, bringing all the living senators together. For those of us in our 40s, myself, Cory Booker, and Mo Cowan, all had a conversation about opportunity and access, and very little said about the issue of race, though without question, race was still part of the conversation. For those, Mr. Burris and for Carol Mosley Braun, the issue of race was paramount and front and center. So the fact of the matter is that if you're Mr. Clyburn's generation, there's no doubt that the issue of race is more predominant in his thinking than it is in mine or in the two other African-American senators who both were Democrats, but also in their 40s.
So you think it's generational, big generational divide here?
There certainly was on stage a divide that was based on generations. Is there still an issue of race in our country? The answer, of course, is yes. Have we made significant progress? The answer, of course, is yes. Can we tell that the issue of race is not only a negative issue of race, but a positive issue of race? So the answer is also yes. So ultimately, what we have to frame is what conversation we're actually having about race. It is not all negative. Significant part of it now is positive. And so you'll find that the issue of race still stirs much emotion, but it's not all a negative vitriol, that there's actually some positive constructive forces at work in race relations as well.
And to the question of poverty, which is what brought us together today.
Yes, ma'am.
Do you feel the similar trajectory there on the question of not just talking about poverty, but actually addressing poverty? I mean, both sides of the aisle, both political perspectives have pointed out that the needle has barely moved on the numbers of who is considered poor in this country. Now, we could argue about what goes into that number, whether it's a good number. But do you feel yourself as a political leader that we are winning whatever war we are waging on poverty or not?
Yeah, Michelle, you said it very well. Good question. Whatever war we are waging against poverty, that is really the question that I'm trying to figure out how to answer, because the answer is obvious that we need to spend more time figuring out what are the root causes of poverty and not simply spending all of our time on the symptoms of poverty. And that's where my opportunity agenda, I think, comes into focus, because ultimately it spends a lot of time examining and trying to eliminate the root cause so that we eliminate the fruit of poverty that we see manifesting in our lives. And so can both parties spend more time on the issue of poverty? I think the answer is yes. Should we? The answer is absolutely yes. And here's my hope, that after 2014 and before 2016, that the issue of poverty will still be paramount in both parties, that this ought not be an election year issue. It should not be an election cycle issue. This should be an issue that we help to eliminate, because America, with 5% of the world's population, we need all hands on deck if we are going to be globally competitive in a fast, very fast changing world.
That was Senator Tim Scott. He is a Republican from South Carolina, and we reached him at his office on Capitol Hill. Senator Scott, thank you so much for speaking with us. I hope we'll speak again.
I look forward to it, Michelle.
Coming up, it looks like Jay-Z has another problem to add to his 99. A leaked security video of his sister-in-law slapping and kicking him in an elevator suggests that there is trouble in hip-hop's royal family. But is it any of our business? We'll ask our beauty shop ladies. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
The CIA and their military establishment was very much concerned that the communists had found techniques for brainwashing.
Does anybody want to go home? No!
On the next Radiolab, one man's attempt to safeguard national security backfires. Amjad Abumrad, join us for the next Radiolab.
Saturdays at 2 on AM 580.
WILL programming is made possible by Community Concierge Magazine. Every issue includes an event calendar, attractions, and maps, as well as a business and shopping guide. Community Concierge Magazine is distributed throughout East Central Illinois and always presents the CU area at its best.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for a visit to the beauty shop. That's where our panel of women journalists and commentators take a fresh cut on the week's news. Sitting in the chairs for a new do this week are Joan Walsh. She is an editor-at-large of Salon.com and an MSNBC political analyst. And Ishii is the editor-in-chief of They're All So Beautiful. That's an online forum that looks at race and dating. Veronica Miller writes about fashion and pop culture for XO Jane and TheGrio.com. And Bridget Johnson is the Washington, D.C. editor for PJ Media. That's a conservative libertarian news and commentary site. Welcome back to you all, ladies. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Michelle.
Thank you.
All right, so let's not pretend. I mean, let's just start with a topic that we know everybody's talking about anyway. Okay. TMZ, a celebrity gossip site, released video that seems to pretty clearly show Jay-Z, the hip-hop mogul, being physically attacked by his wife Beyoncé's younger sister, Solange Knowles. Beyoncé, of course, being, you know, megastar in her own right. And Solange is also known as kind of a fashion maven, a DJ, celebrity DJ, singer. The group was caught on a security camera leaving a Met Gala after party last week, and during what some are calling the longest elevator ride ever, Solange kicked and punched and lunged at her brother-in-law while one of the bodyguards there tried to help get the situation under control. And it isn't clear what led to the altercation, and nobody who was immediately involved has publicly, specifically addressed the incident, but everybody else has. So I just thought I would ask you all what your thoughts are about this. And Joan, I'll start with you.
Oh, thanks. I mean, I'm ambivalent about it, in the sense that I think on the one hand, they've certainly made their love affair, their marriage, their sex life, their baby kind of central to their myth and to their, you know, their status as pop royalty. And so, of course, it kind of invites us into gawk when things go bad. On the other hand, I have a really hard time, you know, talking about what might have happened, because we just don't know. There's no audio from this video. There are rumors out there about what they may have been fighting about, but there's no confirmation. So, you know, it's like we all have to be gawkers. We look at traffic accidents, and, you know, my mom told me to say a prayer, but as long as I said a prayer, I could look. And so I kind of feel the same way here. I hope everybody's okay, but I can't help but look.
And Ishi, what about you? What are your thoughts about this?
Well, first of all, hotel elevators are totally sacred. So I feel like the fact that they broadcast this security camera footage is a little bit unsavory. But after giving it a little bit of thought and, you know, thinking about the other unintended released, not video, but soundtrack of Sterling, Donald Sterling, I have to say, unless Jay-Z told Solange not to bring black people to his shows, I don't think we had any business seeing that video.
Well, why do you say a little bit unsavory? Why not a lot unsavory? I mean, a lot of people are jumping all over V. Stiviana with both feet, even though they think that she in some ways may have done a public service by broadcasting this. They still think it's horrendous. So why a little bit unsavory? Why not a lot unsavory? Is it because they're so famous, or is it because, like what Joan said, that, you know, when you get to be that famous, it's almost like fair game unless you're in your own house?
Well, I think, you know, for a lot of victims of certain kinds of violence or offense, it's really difficult to confront your abuser or attacker or the racist in your life or the bigot or whatever. And I have no idea what happened in that elevator, so I can't conjecture. But if it happens that there's some serious situation going on, then I think, you know, we have to sort of give carte blanche.
Veronica, what do you think?
Yeah, I think the only thing that we do know is that we don't know anything at all about what happened. I think we're so fascinated by it, because the question is, what made her so enraged that those kicks and those punches were flying in that manner? It's just kind of bizarre. And
could have been rum and coke. I mean, it could have been alcohol. I mean, I'm sorry.
Number of things, right. But the one thing I think we can take
away too many
away
cosmos.
From this, yeah, too many. I think the one thing we can definitely take away from this is the PR machine that Beyonce is. Mm-hmm. That woman did not budge. And a lot of people are asking why. They're saying she's a robot. She doesn't care about defending her husband. Yada, yada, yada. No, the reason is that Beyonce is smart. She knows there are eyes and there are cameras everywhere, including hotel elevators, which is why when her sister starts flailing and punching and kicking, you're not going to see Beyonce, this woman who has built a $1 million industry on herself in that Givenchy dress, engaging in fisticuffs with her little sister. It's not going to happen. There are too many endorsement deals, too many tour dates, too many things on the line. And then there's video also afterward of them emerging from the hotel, which is like your standard paparazzi video. And she comes out and she just gives a smile and gets in the limo. And if we hadn't seen the elevator security camera footage, we would have never known anything happened. And I think it's just a testament to how tight the Knowles Carter brand is and trying to, you know, maintain their image and their mystique.
Bridget, what do you think? Bridget Johnson?
I confess I was drawn into when TMZ is like, we have the full-length one now. I'm like, ooh, I gotta go watch this. It was kind of like like an Unsolved Mysteries episode. You kind of hear Robert Stack saying, why did Solange attack Jay-Z? But the answer to that, either way, it's going to compromise their privacy, just like having that video release compromise their privacy. Yeah. You know, Jay did something untoward and Solange was defending her sister. Maybe Solange has a problem with substance abuse or mental abuse. anything that comes out at this point is going to compromise the privacy of that family. So I think we kind of have to let it go in that way.
You know, one of the things I found interesting is that Joan, just looping back to where you started out, saying that they've made their relationship so much a part of their brand. I actually disagree. I think that, for example, it was years before Jay-Z and Beyonce even acknowledged that they were dating. And unlike even a lot of couples who are not celebrities, there has never been a photo that they have ever released of their wedding. I mean, their wedding was a private matter. They did not put it on Facebook. They didn't put it on Instagram. They didn't do any of that stuff. And I just think they've been very selective about what it's true that they have, you know, she released this documentary. But one of the things that people noted about herself last year in her tour, but one of the things that a lot of people noted about it was that she really didn't tell you a whole lot that you couldn't glean from a lot of other things. Right. I mean, it was kind of an extended music video. The other part I find interesting is what happened to emotion. What happened to appreciating people for having emotional control? Mm. I mean, it's as if, you know, if you're not like putting all your personal business in the street, that there's something wrong with you. But it used to be considered classy to keep your business to yourself, to keep your family's business in the house. Absolutely. And to try to deal with your stuff privately. And so I guess I find it kind of interesting that, you know, as public figures, it's almost as if they owe us this. And you know,
no, I certainly don't believe they owe us this at all. I would say that in the last year, I think their focus has shifted a little bit, and they've certainly let us in a little more, even just thinking about the Grammy appearance.
Sure.
But I certainly don't think they deserve this. And I also, you know, I had the same reaction on one level to her stoicism in that elevator. On the one level, it's remarkable, and you're like, wow, how can she do this? But on the other, you know, she has supreme self-control, and she seems to be the only one for certain who might have an inkling in the back of her mind that, hey, even an elevator in a fancy hotel is not a safe private space. And so, you know, she handled herself, and she deserves credit, not blame for that.
Only one more thing I want to mention, and this is one of the points that I hope she doesn't mind my mentioning this, our editor, Alicia Montgomery, you know, raised in a conversation we were having about this, is that people often talk about Jay-Z for being a misogynist, especially because of his lyrics from earlier in his career. Notable that he does not defend himself or raise a hand to this young woman, you know, at all, and that his only physical reaction seems to be to try to get away and I just think that that's something to note. Like, again, not knowing at all what precipitated this, but whether words or inappropriate words were exchanged or insulting, you know, what they call, you know, fighting words under the law were uttered. But I think that, you know, had the situation been reversed and he slapped this young woman in the elevator or kicked her, we would certainly be having a different reaction to it.
And
I just feel like, I need to, you know, to point out that, you know, so that's all. So for now, I think, maybe. If you're just joining us, we're talking about this week's Hot Topics with Joan Walsh of Salon.com and Ishi of They're All So Beautiful, Veronica Miller of XO Jane and the Griot, and Bridget Johnson of PJ Media. And we are on the topic of privacy, so I'm going to switch gears now, and we're talking about what happens behind closed doors. I want to talk about another video that's making waves for a very different reason. Emily Letts is a counselor at a women's clinic in New Jersey, and she decided that she needed to have an abortion. She decided that she would videotape it. The video lasts about 3 minutes. It is not graphic at all. It focuses on her face and her reactions and what she's experiencing through her eyes. But Let says she made the video because she wanted to destigmatize the procedure. This video has gone viral, and as you can imagine, it has sparked many strong reactions from people on all sides of this issue. And I'll start with you, Veronica, and I'll just ask you, if you don't mind, because as a young woman who, you know, is of the similar in age to this young woman, if you found her reasons for putting it online valid.
I find them very valid. I mean, you know, I'm 30, and I'm in this demographic where we're delaying marriage, we're delaying having children, we're delaying all these things. So we're spending a lot of our time and mental energy on thinking about birth control and how to, like, you know, live our lives and not have any surprises, because we know that, you know, we might be in a unsteady economic situation, job situation, whatever. And I think that the video is helpful because the mere thought of having to make that decision to terminate a pregnancy is terrifying for young women because of the implications of the stigma and everything. And I think that having that video kind of opens up that conversation and it allows, you know, women to see, okay, you don't have to be scared, or just, it just takes the, you know, the scariness away from thinking about having to have that procedure. And also kind of a comfort saying, this is okay. I've done this too, which I'm sure, you know, in her role as a counselor at the Women's Center, she's probably has those conversations about this is okay. This is a thing that we deal with and we have to learn how to handle.
Okay. I need to get the other voices in here on this point because I want to hear from everybody on this. Bridget, what about you?
Well, you know, she is a counselor at the center where she had the abortion, and she said in an interview afterwards that she was not using birth control and she didn't have any long-term partners, so that of course, makes me kind of cringe. What kind of advice is she giving to women to protect themselves from STDs and pregnancy?
Well, one of the points she makes in her essay about it is that she has been a hypocrite and that she is going to do better. She kind of so anyway, but your point,
It should open up a broader conversation. You know, first of all, of course, you know, every clinic that a woman's going to isn't as nice as that one. we know that from recent stories. But it also should open a conversation on the right about, you know, what should actually the message be. You know, the right needs to acknowledge people have sex. Not every woman gets excited when she sees a positive on a pregnancy test. There needs to be a broader conversation open about what do you do to support women who want to make this choice instead of just telling them don't.
Do you find it offensive as a person who does not share her political beliefs on this question? Do you find it offensive to, or some people just, you know, as you can imagine, there was a lot of outrage about this. It was put up on a lot of pro-life sites, and you can imagine what the vitriol that was directed at her.
Right.
But do you find it offensive?
And I know there are some theories about whether or not it was authentic, because she did enter in a contest afterwards. But I wouldn't say offensive as a bit disturbing. But I think that you need to take that and not just get outraged about it, but turn it into a conversation point.
And what do you think?
Well, I have to say, as a YouTube snob, I'm offended. the stylistics kind of bothered me because, you know, and I think this is a generational thing. I think abortion actually has to be treated as even more realistic than that because most of them are not surgical, actually. So, and I would have been nice to have seen a video of somebody taking pills, for example, which is how most abortions are performed. And that's not to destigmatize it or, you know, whatever. I personally am pro-choice. And I'd say, you know, if we're ready for night vision sex tapes, then we ought to be ready for abortion videos.
Tom, what do you say about this? You say you had no interest in watching it. Want to tell us more about that?
I had no interest in watching it, but I'm perfectly happy that it's out there. I think that this is a decision that's been so stigmatized and sensationalized and made into, you know, a horrible, horrifying tragedy by the right. And there's been so much public moral and political outrage about a private choice that I think it's great that Emily put it out there for women who may have been affected by the campaign against abortion.
But you don't want to watch it yourself. You feel because
no,
what?
I don't want to watch. I didn't feel any need to watch it. I felt like, again, you know, choice is about choice, and no one's saying I have to watch it, and no one's saying Bridget has to watch it. But it's out there and it's on YouTube, as offensive as the aesthetics may be to, and you know, for women or whomever to go look and see what they can learn from it, and I'm happy it's there.
So before we go, let me ask about another person who upset a lot of people with comments he thought were private and seems to be our subject for today. The Donald Sterling saga continues. He sat down with Anderson Cooper earlier this week, and he made comments about Magic Johnson, saying that Magic Johnson was not a suitable role model because he has AIDS. He also apologized for negative comments about black people. He said he isn't a racist. We don't have time to play that clip, but I think you get the gist of it. He says he's not a racist, and I just have to ask, maybe Joan, maybe I'll go to you first on this, and maybe you have Veronica thoughts about this. Made it. I think I was most interested in the fact that his wife says she should not have to deal with, she should not have to be held accountable for her husband's conduct, and she should still be able to keep her share of the clippers. And your thoughts about that?
Well, I think that's completely wrong. I think that she deserves, if they divorce or if they stay together, she deserves half of whatever he makes from the sale. But you know, the NBA ownership constitution, which we're not allowed to know about, which is kind of crazy to me, you know, is allegedly very clear about, you know, him being the person who's made the agreement and thus is the person who has to abide by the agreement. And so handing it over to her is not a solution. I was also struck by, you know, he wanted us, Donald Sterling wanted us to think that V. Stiviano's magic lady parts tricked him into saying these racist things. And, you know, men will say anything for sex. He seemed to be making that appeal. And yet what he said to Anderson Cooper in public with full knowledge that it was going out to the entire country, the world, was in some ways more, was at least, let's just say, as offensive as what he said to her behind closed doors. And it just showed that this is the way he thinks about African Americans, and that not only would he slur and slander Magic Johnson, who I think really changed the way we thought about HIV/AIDS when he came out with his illness status when he did, but also has been a philanthropist. And you know, it's so condescending that he can speak for who has helped African-American people and that they don't always help each other. It was just so offensive from start to finish.
Oh, Veronica, I'm sorry, I don't have time for you, but I do have time to applaud you on your graduation from design school next week.
Thank you.
So big shout out to Veronica. Veronica Miller writes about pop culture and fashion for thegriot.com with us from Philadelphia. Joan Walsh is the editor-at-large of salon.com. And Ishii is editor-in-chief of They're All So Beautiful. That's a site that looks at race and dating. They joined us from our bureau in New York. Bridget Johnson is the Washington, D.C. editor for PJ Media. She joined us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you, ladies.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
Just ahead, writer Michael Arsenault came of age as a black gay man at a time when AIDS was seen as a death sentence. He says it gave him a fear of sex. We'll talk about it, and yes, it is a grown folks conversation, but one we think you will want to hear. That's coming up on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from LifeLock, reminding consumers that identity thieves target bank and savings accounts of victims. Learn more at LifeLock.com, code NPR. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to build a culture of health for all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. From the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, at fordfoundation.org. And from Joyce V. Hale, in the interest of engaging an informed and civil electorate. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Glenn Greenwald talks about the journalistic decisions he's made since Edward Snowden gave him tens of thousands of classified documents about secret NSA surveillance programs. And we'll talk about what some of those documents reveal. Greenwald has written a new book called No Place to Hide: Edward Snowden, the NSA, and the U.S. Surveillance State. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
This October, come aboard WILL's American History Train. We'll travel in private rail cars restored to their 1950s glory. Our private chef will serve delicious onboard meals as we travel to Boston, Washington, D.C., and Philadelphia for stops at historic sites, museums, and battlefields on this 10-day trip. For more information, call 217-333-7300 or visit will.illinois.edu/willtravel.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza, with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at SubaruofChampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Let's turn now to something many people still find hard to talk about, which is sexuality. At same-sex attraction, and it gets even more difficult for many people, something we were reminded of recently when Michael Sam, an openly gay college player, was selected in the NFL draft by the St. Louis Rams. ESPN was there to document the moment, which included a kiss he shared with his boyfriend upon learning the happy news. The response is still raging across social media, with some saying it's about time, others expressing annoyance and anger, and still others expressing anger at that anger. What's that all about? We were thinking about how, at a time when America's laws and much of its society is ever more welcoming to LGBT people, expressing sexuality, especially for gay men, is still so controversial and sometimes even dangerous. And now writer Michael Arsenault is adding even more complication to the story by writing about his own fear of expressing his sexuality as a gay man. This very personal essay was written for the site Exo Jane. His essay is titled, At 30, I'm Finally Tackling My Intense Fear of Sex. As you might imagine, this conversation may not be appropriate for all listeners. So with that being said, Michael Arsenault is with us now. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
How does it feel hearing me talk about the piece?
I'm really surprised by the reaction I've gotten from it. I really didn't have any expectations, but I'm not very sentimental, but a warm feeling about like the way people have reached out to me about it. It's really humbling, and I really have appreciated it.
How have people reached out to you about the piece, saying it really resonates, they're seeing themselves in it?
I've had a lot of straight people, actually, which is funny. Normally when I write anything gay-related, I get a lot of straight reaction, more so than I do gay reaction sometimes. But a lot of people either, they say that they've been there, gay or straight, or they just are really proud of me because I'm a pretty open person, but I'm very cautious about writing about certain things, and especially sex, because for me, there's still kind of some complications with family and their reaction and kind of like a pushback. But I'm really happy that I wrote the piece, and I hope to write more.
What made you want to write this piece, and why now?
You know what? Years ago, there was a story about two young black boys who committed suicide within the same month, and I know what it's like to be taunted when people have suspicions about you not being hard enough or they're assuming that you're gay. So that was kind of like the start of it. And I wrote a piece, and I had already come out to myself and my friends, which honestly was more important to me at 21. And then I told my mom finally after the piece got a lot of traction at 25. But even now, I just think for me, I don't necessarily see myself, I don't hear myself. And as a gay black writer, I need to lend my voice to something. That just was the driving force.
So let's talk about the piece for people who haven't had a chance to read it yet. You write that your fears started well before you came out, and it was connected to the way your parents responded to gay people in your family. Why don't you pick it up from there?
Yes. At the age of six, the very first funeral I ever went to, my uncle died of AIDS. And while he was a drug addict, he was also a gay man, which is the more likely culprit behind his death. And for me, my father, his reaction was very much like, you know, his brother was a faggot, and something that was something my mom denied. It was many years later that she acknowledged that he was actually gay, but I mean, with the use of that word, that's how I learned what it meant to be gay. And, you know, when you're six, and I don't really remember much about the funeral, but I remember seeing him in that casket, and I remember crying, and I just remember like a lot of anger and shame around it. And for me, that always stuck with me. And as a gay man, even now, I just in their 30, I've seen people die of AIDS. So AIDS has always been like in the back of my mind. It's been hard not to not think about it sometimes.
So do you think that you kind of locked into this idea that being gay meant being sick? Is that what you think it meant?
Yeah, because even without my uncle, I can remember Pedro on The Real World. I would like to think I'm a bit more modern. Obviously, I'm not my parents. I'm not 60 years old, but sex can still lead to death if you're not very cautious. And this is especially true for a lot of gay and black Latino men. It's hard not to think about it because it's always around you. Even if no one says it, you can't help. But, you know, people drop off like flies every so often. I still see that on Facebook. So it's always there. But I'm learning not to let that control me and how I pleasure myself.
Well, but, you know, but the fact is that that is the argument that many people who are hostile to same-sex relationships, particularly same-sex relationships involving men, that's the argument that they've made, is that this is how you know this is wrong, right? Because people get sick and die. That is one of the political arguments that's been made against advancing the rights of LGBT people. Do you think that's the part of it that you heard, or do you think it's more like a visceral people you saw around you? What do you think?
Mm-hmm. I don't really particularly care anymore, and haven't for a while, about what other people thought about me being a gay man. Because, I mean, by now, most people are, you can easily die from being straight. And I think even with respect to a lot of the young gay black and Latino men dying now, that's more about people not necessarily being able to reach them with the resources and education that they need. And I think, frankly, a lot of people are still very ignorant about sex. You know, we're only now lowering the teen pregnancy rate. So in that respect, you know, we just don't really talk about sex. So I'm trying not to put this in a nice way, but I just generally don't care what people think as far as that goes, like the fodder.
You know, the politics of it isn't what's concerning you. It's still personal. Well, I got to be honest with you about the piece. I think that that's what struck with me is that just what a personal pain this was to you. And it wasn't that you weren't having sexual feelings. It was that it was something else. So tell me as much as you can, as appropriately as you can, if you would, bearing in mind that we have a very general, you know, audience, how you think this affected your life. I mean, you still sought relationships, right? How did it play itself out in your life?
I'm going to keep this BG, Beyonce before partition. I'm very sexual. I am like many people, many men. You know, I have sexual desires like anyone else. I think about sex a lot. And in the piece, I acknowledge, it's not that I didn't necessarily act on those emotions, but a lot of time I would initiate something and then stop it because, again, that fear of intimacy, the fear of the consequences of my actions, it would stop me and it would make a lot of people angry. And they had a right to be angry. The same way, I grew up with alcoholism in the home, but I drink, you know. Sometimes I get drunk. I'm not belligerent, but it's kind of like the same principle. Like, sex can be dangerous, but if I protect myself and if I'm cautious, if I ask the right questions, if I'm doing what I need to do, why not enjoy it? The same way I go to happy hour. Probably might go to happy hour later. Probably might have sex later. I'm kidding. But you never know. But I just know that I'm preparing myself the best way, not letting a fear kind of like continue to kind of debilitate me.
If you're just joining us, we're having a conversation some might find sensitive. We are speaking with writer Michael Arsenault, and he wrote about confronting his fear of sex as a Black gay man. You also say that you had this fear, but you also then engaged in behavior you know could be dangerous, you know, being intimate with people who you barely knew, right? In situations and not taking every step to protect yourself as you could. So what do you think that's about?
I think when you're dealing with the hurt and isolation and not necessarily being accepted by people close to you, you act out in different ways. So there were moments when I felt weak. I would prefer to love the person I'm having sex with, but you know what? Sometimes love takes a while, so you want to just at least get your urges out. And I sometimes, I didn't know, go into full detail, but you know, I remember being on 125th, being angry, seeing somebody, trying to make that happen, was letting it happen, then I stopped because I came to my senses. But you know, I could have just as easily gone through with that the way a lot of other people have and ended up with kind of like some life-changing consequence. Fortunately, I caught myself, but it's hard for people to cope. And a lot of times, necessarily with gay men or gay women, they don't necessarily know how to cope because it can be a lonely feeling still. I know we're a lot more accepting and all of that, but not completely.
You write at one point in the piece, I wish this was the part, and this is after you even had some health issues that you hadn't really dealt with appropriately because you were trying to work through all this. But you write at one point in the piece, I wish this was the part where I said, and it was then that I decided that my libido had been left in the icebox for far too long and it's time to overcome my fears and set it free. Yeah, that didn't happen. And then, but you said it wasn't until a year ago or so, you sort of dealt with yourself and you said, I know the answer. I'm mortified. So what is it you think finally made you kind of look yourself squarely in the face and say, this is what's going on with me. I got to deal with it. What do you think it was?
Yeah, honestly, I wish Mariah Carey was playing in the background and suddenly like butterflies would appear and I just would have gotten it. But I literally woke up one day and to be fair, a few of my friends had been putting in my head that I needed to be having sex to kind of de-stress myself. But literally one day I just looked and said, why aren't you having sex? Why are you not having sex? And I mean, like, going all the way, like, having sex. Not the everything but, not the whatever, foreplay. Why are you denying yourself? And it literally just hit me one day, and then things change. And I just kind of opened myself up more. And the minute sometimes when you realize what you need to be doing, it might not happen literally seconds after, but it didn't take long, and I haven't regretted anything that I've done. I still have those concerns. But, you know, as I put in the piece, I'm just a lot more practical about it, realistic. Sex is fantastic and people should have it if they want to. Not for me. I finally got it.
You wrote this piece before the whole Michael Sam thing and all that other stuff came out. No pun intended. what do you hope will be the response from this piece? Do you have someone in mind who you hope will read it? Is there some response you hope will flow from it?
You know, full disclosure, I will say, I've had dealings before when I've written personal essays and kind of like a pushback about wanting to write about my experience as a gay black man. And I've heard reactions a lot of time, particularly from agents, what have you, that because I'm a gay black man, my appeal is very limited, which I find ridiculous because if you turn on the radio, if you turn on television, you might not see the gay black men behind a lot of this stuff. But right now, gay black male subculture is very popular. So for me, this is partially cathartic. But also, I want to show that my voice matters just as much as anyone else's, and I'm not limited by my race or my sexuality. People can appeal to me no matter what they look like or no matter what I look like. If it's a good story, it's a good story. So part of it is that, just a wee bit resentment.
I hear you. I want to emphasize again that we called you and you wrote this piece before all this, you know, hullabaloo around Michael Sam. But I was interested if you had any reaction to either the kiss or any reaction to the reaction, anything you wanted to say about it.
I was actually in a bar in Harlem when that first aired. And next to me, there was a bunch of dudes who clearly were disgusted and continued to go on and on and on about how disgusted they were. To be fair, I don't always like public displays of affection either, although I've recently dabbled and accepted into my life. But that said, I think that matters. You know, those reactions will be those reactions, but we do need to see that. Maybe not over and over and over again, but I would say that about any straight couple doing that. But I think it still matters because we need to see Michael Sam and we need to hear a Frank Ocean who may not necessarily identify as a gay black man, but can sing intimately about his love of a man and how it sounds just like anything else. Or even Azealia Banks, who raps about sometimes having sex with women and it's really much ado about nothing. I think all of this really matters because we're not as evolved as we like to pretend that we are. And we still don't really see a lot of LGBT people of color do that. So I think it really matters because I think there is some little black boy, a little black girl looking at this and it helps.
Michael Arsenault is a writer. His piece about his fear of sex appeared on the website XO Jane, and he was kind enough to join us from our bureau in New York. Michael Arsenault, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you again for having me.
Finally today, shout out to Barbara Walters on the occasion of her last official week on the air. Her Friday appearance on The View, the talk show she founded, is scheduled to be her last regular appearance on a broadcast. Well, we could certainly spend the next few minutes paying tribute to her for all the juicy scoop she's landed and all the glass ceilings she has busted. What I really want to do is point out what her life story has to do with another ongoing story, the plight of those kidnapped Nigerian girls whose ordeal enters its fourth week. At which point you ask, what do the experiences of a super rich American broadcasting star have to do with all those girls from one of the poorest and most volatile parts of Nigeria? Can I just tell you, Barbara Walters is important not just for her work, but for what she made of it, not least the fact that she made sure she got paid for it. Her decision to leave NBC for ABC in 1976, a front-page story at the time, made her not only the first woman co-anchor ever to present the evening news at a major network, but also, it was reported at the time, the world's highest-paid newscaster. This stands out even now as women continue to earn lower pay for doing the same jobs as men, even when they have the same credentials. The Economic Policy Institute just issued another study about this recently, showing that this divergence starts at the earliest stages of a woman's work life. Now, there's all kinds of reasonable debate about why that is. Is it because women have a confidence gap or take more time off for family? But it cannot be ignored. It matters because women are heading up more households, either because they choose not to marry or are widowed or divorced, or are single parents or, and sometimes and, supporting elderly parents and other relatives. Every dollar women don't get that would be theirs if they were men is a dollar that isn't buying school books or paying the salary of a caregiver or going into a retirement fund. At one point, Barbara Walters was doing all of those things, supporting relatives, raising a child on her own. And as she said in her memoir, she knew she had to earn enough to do all those things. And she was ridiculed and resented for it. The research shows this often happens to women who stand up for themselves in professional negotiations. This research was recently reported by my NPR colleague Shankar Vedantam on Morning Edition in a series on women and work, and I thought, that's interesting. And lo and behold, just this week I got a letter saying, and I quote, that I am often too crisp and self-assured on the air. And trust me when I say this was not meant as a compliment. Does anybody criticize my male colleagues for being self-assured? Maybe, but I don't think so. Now, what does this have to do with those kidnapped Nigerian girls? Many of our colleagues in the media, but most notably Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times, have pointed out that extremists and fanatics target girls' schools because, quote, there is no force more powerful to transform a society, and the greatest threat to extremism is girls reading books, unquote. Kristof says it's in part because educated women have fewer children, but more broadly, it's because girls' education doubles the formal labor force, raising living standards and promoting more productive development, which in turn creates a cycle that offers fewer justifications for extremism and fewer angry people with a lot of time on their hands to carry it out. Economists call this a virtuous cycle, but that cycle, even in the most developed economies, is not complete until women can not only compete fairly in the labor force if they so choose, but be compensated appropriately when they deliver. I'd say Barbara Walters delivered. And I say thank you. And to the person who said I am too crisp and self-assured, I will simply say thank you to you too. I take it as a compliment. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Tune in for more talk tomorrow.